Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a veteran CIA officer who served in the Middle East, Robert Baer, and discuss the endgame of the Syrian civil war that is likely to intensify, as well as comment on the revival of the issue of the use of torture depicted in the new movie Zero Dark Thirty. We'll also examine the real reasons behind General Petraeus' ignominious departure as head of the CIA in what amounts to a bloodless political assassination. Then we'll continue our examination of the Syrian tragedy as not just lives, but a country is being destroyed, with Charles Glass, who was ABC News' chief Middle East correspondent and is the author of Tribes and Flags, Adventure and Kidnap in Greater Syria. We will discuss his article at the New York Review of Books, Aleppo, How Syria is Being Destroyed. Then finally, in the aftermath of the worst mass killing in America since the Virginia Tech massacre, we will speak with Colin Goddard, who was shot four times and was one out of seven of a class of 17 to survive the Virginia Tech shooting, with three of the four bullets still in his body. With calls to revive the assault weapons ban, we will discuss the NRA's continuing role in preventing law enforcement authorities from correlating data on those with mental illness and those who are able to purchase military-style firearms. And joining us now is Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with a New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hi, Ian. It's great to be back.
And do you think the end game is happening in Syria? Even the Russians, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia the other day suggested that the rebels are probably going to win, and they're calling on Russians to start to evacuate. So do you think that the end is near?
I think we got a ways to go. I keep in touch with the Alawites in the regime. They don't intend to give up. This conflict is so misunderstood in this country. For a start, Bashar al-Assad, the president, could leave today and it would continue. What we're faced with is an army, elite units, which are doing most of the fighting, the 4th Division, who are commanded by Alawites. A lot of the soldiers are Christians. They are a beleaguered minority. They think that if the rebels take over, that they will be slaughtered. They think their backs are the wall. This is not a case of a dictatorship, of one man having gone crazy. It's not the way the country works. It's generals from his promotion, which control the fighting, and as I said, would continue to fight on. Now, I've heard anecdotal stories. I certainly couldn't vouch for them, that some of the Alawites are going into Lebanon, moving north, and going up to what's called the Alawite Mountains above Latakia on the Mediterranean. That's where they're traditionally from. You know, is there going to be some huge resettlement at some point? I don't know. What I can tell you is that if these people get desperate enough, and they do think they're going to die, the Alawites, they will use whatever weapons they have to fight back.
Well, of course, the issue over chemical weapons came up recently. A lot of the reports of the imminent use of chemical weapons, I think, were coming from Israel. The Secretary of Defense suggested that they were a little bit overwrought. But at the end of the day, you think that could be the issue, the chemical arsenal?
I think absolutely. I mean, look, you know, we don't know who's going to take over Syria for a start. Is it some sort of al-Qaeda-like organization, the same sort of people that attacked our consulate in Benghazi? Is it going to be moderate? Is it going to be secular? We just don't know. It's impossible to find out who's doing the actual fighting and which way the power, and the balance of power has shifted. It could be to the Alawite. I mean, it could be to fundamentalists. It could be, we just don't know. So there's that question, who's going to get the sarin at the end of the day? And there's also VX, extremely potent chemical weapons. They're binary. And we also don't know, you know, if the Al Whites hold on to them, will they use them? And, you know, it's a guess. My call is they probably would, to cover the retreats, to, you know, or some general would lose his mind and fire these things. So I'm not sure that, you know, any sign that these weapons are being pulled out of garrison are being mixed is really, we're up at, you know, the boiling point where this is going to really cause problems in the region.
So Robert Baer, again, a veteran CIA operations officer, served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, the author of three New York Times bestsellers. The head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, has gone public in saying that the rebels aren't going to win, and apparently Hezbollah is sending forces in, and apparently the Iranians are sending arms in around the clock, and the Quds forces, etc. So is that rhetoric or is that reality? Would Hezbollah and Iran be able to tip the balance if they, I mean, it seems like the Iranians are making a serious investment and are pouring reinforcements in.
Well, no. I mean, they can't, the Iranians can't fight in Syria. I mean, you're not going to see the Quds force, which is fairly small, setting up in cities to fight street for this regime. That would worsen the conflict because the Iranians are generally detested in Syria, and they're detested by the rebels and the Sunni fundamentalists and by the Kurds. Hezbollah is much too small to go in and fight street by street. It's never fought street by street. It's a guerrilla force that operates out of caves in southern Lebanon. It did very well against the Israelis in 2006. But they're in no way what we would consider a conventional army. You know, they can do small things like help with intercepting communications or, you know, that. But it's not going to sway the outcome of this war in by no means.
But so just to wrap up on Syria then, Robert Baer, the end is not that near. The Alawites still have enormous resources. They believe, and I think the evidence is mounting, that they will be slaughtered. I saw, just anecdotally, I saw an interview with a member of the Free Syrian Army saying he just wanted to kill them all. Made no bones about it.
Well, Ian, you have to look at the way the rebels look at it is they are heretics. And in Islam, you cannot, heretics are to be put to the sword. And these people, the Alawites, believe in the Trinity, which is completely contrary to traditional Islam. And so if you go by the Quran, they would be justified in putting them, you know, of slaughtering them. You know, it's an unpleasant truth, but true.
Well, when the U.S. bans it, one of the rebel groups, Al-Nusra it's called, and another rebel group apparently also that's involved in some of the recent fighting that involved the Palestinian refugee camp, who finances them? We hear that money comes from Qatar and from Saudi. Is this individuals that's financing the fundamentalist rebels, or is it official policy?
No, it's official policy. You got this coming out of the Emirates. You've got money coming out of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, as they've always done, as they did in Afghanistan in the 80s. They give money to the Salafis who live in the Gulf. I mean, the people can get a hold of the arms or the people willing to go fight. Because none of these countries have what we would consider, you know, effective intelligence services where they're putting people on the ground and sorting out who is who. No, this has all been outsourced. Libya was outsourced to the Salafis. Syria is being outsourced to the Salafis. You've got in Turkey, you've got a group that's sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood / Salafis. I mean, it's a continuum. It's hard to say who stands exactly where, but ultimately the Gulf states don't have much control of who ends up with the arms. All they want to know is that they're fighting, it's not such a cold war, but they're fighting a war against Iran. And if the regime in Damascus is close to Tehran, they will do everything they can to bring it down. And it's just the nature of the conflict and see what happens afterwards.
But is that to say that the Saudis and the Qataris want a theocracy, a very, very fundamentalist, xenophobic theocracy influenced by Al-Qaeda on the Mediterranean?
It's more complicated than that. What they want is a theocracy in Libya and Syria and the other countries, but not in their own country. You're trying to keep the crazies at bay, the Salafis, and what they figure out, what they believe, is if they send them to places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and, you know, Tunisia and everywhere else this is going on, they won't be threatening their rule. This is, for them, it's a question of survival. Keep in mind that the Salafis are only 10%, you know, of maybe it's that much of the population of these countries, yet they fight about their weight, just as the communists did in 1917 in Russia. Mm-hmm. They were a small minority, but they were determined, and they're armed.
But it does feel like it's the Saudi foreign policy to spread Salafism and fundamentalism. That's what they did in Egypt. They financed the Salafists, who surprised everybody, and were the second biggest bloc in the new parliament.
Oh, I think it's out of their hands. But all these people are thinking in terms of survival. If they can appease the Salafis in their own country by sending them abroad, it works for them. Mm-hmm. It gives them a couple extra years.
You're talking about the House of Saud. The
House of Saud. Everything they do is based on survival.
Right.
Whether it's allying with the United States, whether it's setting up secret channels with Israel, whether it's funding Sunni fundamentalists in Iraq to fight the Iranians, it's all about survival. On one side you have Iran, on the other side is you have the Wahhabis or the Salafis or whatever you want to call them, and they're in between. They do not have some evil intention to recreate the caliphate. I think there's just no evidence for it. And they're just much more pragmatic than that. Well, you say it's ultimately destructive, and I agree it's destructive.
Right. Well, they're sitting on tons of money. That's what it comes down to, right?
They're everything is outsourced.
Right.
Everything. They won't fight themselves. You won't see a Saudi prince fighting in Syria.
Right.
They'll give the money to the Salafis, and off they go.
Well, Robert Baird, let's turn to another issue that I wanted to talk to you about, because we've spoken about it before, and that is that the issue of torture and the use of torture and how the use of torture may have led to the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden has been brought forth, reviving the debate through the movie Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's new movie, which I just saw last night. And the first third of the movie, frankly, is about torture and the early days under Cheney of them trying to break these people. And then I'd say about in the second third of the movie, they play, for example, in the background, a clip of Barack Obama on 60 Minutes condemning torture. And then the characters in the film more or less say, well, you know, at one point they will say now the detainees in Guantanamo have lawyers. So the attitude from the CIA people depicted in this movie was that their hands are being tied by Obama. So what's your sense? Because I've spoken to you about this. I've spoken to Glenn Carl, who exposed the folly of torture at the CIA and the bogus finding by John Yoo that was the basis of it. And also I've spoken to Ali Soufran from the FBI, who also exposed the folly and failure of torture. So what's your take on this issue coming back via this movie?
Well, let's put it this way. Catherine Bigelow is a very good filmmaker, and she needed to up this story. It couldn't be one rescue mission. The SEALs going into Abbottabad. She needed to turn this into a dramatic representation. And in the course of that, she completely misrepresented the truth. There is absolutely no evidence, none, zero, that torture contributed to finding bin Laden. The Senate this Thursday came out, announced its report that there was no evidence that torture worked. The Republicans voted against it, not because it was inaccurate. It was just on a technicality, but McCain has come out and supported it. The fact is that bin Laden found with cooperating human sources, monitoring chatter, looking at the record, analysis, and so forth. Traditional espionage. I know that the former director of operations, Jose Rodriguez, has come out and wrote a book. I know that the conservatives that say the torture works, it doesn't. I spent a lot of time talking to the SEALs about the so-called SEER course, where they're waterboarded in that. All of the psychologists that work with the SEALs and the Special Operations Command will tell you waterboarding is a way to break people. It's not a way to extract information. It's a way to take prisoners of war, force them to make statements on television, denounce the war. But it has never produced reliable intelligence. So, you know, for Catherine Bigelow to claim that this movie in any sense is a docudrama is just, it's just wrong. It's absolutely wrong. I've spent a lot of time looking at this. I doubted it at the beginning because I looked at Middle East services, the torture. They always had the worst intelligence. So did the Chinese because they just got false leads. And I think this movie does a disservice because next time we have an attack on this country, people are going to remember the movie just as they remembered Oliver Stone's JFK, the Kennedy conspiracy. You know, was behind this, you know, was due to this, you know, conspiracy and assassination. It's just wrong. We cannot get our truths from Hollywood. Catherine Bigelow's movie, The Hurt Locker, was brilliant, but anybody who's dealt with DOD teams knows it was complete Hollywood fantasy. Not the way it works. Good movie, no truth.
Well, you know, she's a friend of mine, so I'm not comfortable in a sense.
Well, yeah.
But let me just add that she was given access to the actual woman who's the main character, played by Jessica Chastain. This apparently this fairly feisty and irreverent woman in the CIA who is given credit for being the main Bin Laden hunter, and they were given access to her. So obviously, to some extent, it's this woman's story. That's what she told them, isn't it?
Yeah, but don't forget that this woman was the same woman who prevented the FBI from getting the memo about the two 9/11 hijackers down in San Diego. I mean, it's a complicated story. She would not allow the FBI to be told about Khalid Mihdhar down in San Diego. She is feisty. She did learn. She's also the one that was behind the mistaken kidnapping of a German, Khaled Masri, who turned out to be completely innocent. He was tortured. So this is much more complicated. And, plus the CIA simply cannot sit down and tell Catherine Bigelow how Bin Laden was caught. So, I was involved in a movie with Hollywood too, Syriana. There's just very little truth to the whole movie. It was not a docudrama. I mean, you know, and I went along with it because it was good entertainment. What do I know about entertainment? I just know that if I had written the script, it wouldn't have been never made. So, you know, script writers, you can't expect them. So what all they do is they get into a narrative, they find out what the dramatic turning points are that are important for the movie, and they put it in the movie as they rightly should. But what you can't do is come out and say that this is the way Bin Laden was caught, because it's not true. I don't care what the CIA said, and I don't care what the director of operations said who supported torture. It doesn't work, and it didn't in this case. Go with the Senate findings.
Well, Bob Baer, when you tell us, which I didn't know, that the woman in the CIA who's the main character that the movie's based on, the new movie by Catherine Bigelow, Zero Dark Thirty, that she was responsible for preventing the FBI from finding out about these two 9/11 hijackers down in San Diego. So does that to say that this woman is trying to atone for that enormous failure? Because that was obviously an opportunity to prevent 9/11.
No, I don't think it's a question of that. It's a question there's a learning curve. The CIA was asked to go from a fairly passive collection intelligence service to an active one. You know, in the 90s, yeah, fine, the blinking red light, the tenant talked about, you know, they were coming our way. That was not actionable intelligence. You know, tracing Khalid Mihdhar and not having turning the FBI loose on him was a judgment call. And you know, in light of 9/11, it was a bad one. But they're all bad when things go wrong. What happened with this woman, as I understand, is that she went through a learning curve. I've been through them myself. Where you start out completely ignorant of a subject, something terrible happens, and yes, you do sit down and you become obsessed with taking every bit of information from wherever you can get and trying to combine it. Now, exactly what she did to find bin Laden, I don't know. But, you know, you look at the press reporting, and it's impressive. And she is abrasive, which isn't allowed for women in the CIA. Men can be abrasive, and they usually are. You know, it's a two-tier standard. And, you know, this pain of 9/11 certainly focused her attention. And in that sense, she's heroic. But what I think would still comes back to torture. There is an official record. Every document has been gone through related to the hostile interrogations of these people. And it never at any point did one interrogation where waterboarding or any other abusive methods were used produced a piece of information which proved key to locating bin Laden.
Well, Robert Baer, again, veteran CIA operations officer, served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, and the author of three New York Times bestsellers. Just another touch on a quick subject, if I can. We're going to play the tape of the solicitation of General Petraeus by Fox News. An emissary was sent over to Kabul just before Petraeus took the CIA job. And she, K.T. McFarland, operating as an emissary of the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes, offers Petraeus the presidency. Essentially, all he has to do is sign on the dotted line. Roger Ailes will take leave from Fox News, run the campaign. She says, you know, it'll be an inside job. You'll have Fox News on your side. And Rupert Murdoch will finance the whole thing. Bob Woodward of the Washington Post released this tape. I don't know how he got hold of it or who recorded it. But my assumption would be that President Obama would have heard this tape or heard about this tape, would he not? And that the very fact that Fox and Murdoch and Ailes are trying to recruit Petraeus to run for president against him, either in 2012 or later in 2016, surely would have gotten the president's attention. And perhaps that's why he put him at CIA, was to get him off the street.
Oh, I think no doubt. You know, get him out of the field. I think he was a threat. I think Petraeus, my opinion, my humble opinion, is would have made a better candidate than Romney. He certainly had more political sense than Romney did. He's a four-star general. He extracted us from Iraq. He was part of the surge in Afghanistan. And we're all looking for heroes. He's very presentable. I think no doubt that's why Obama put him at the CIA, wanted to keep him in the tent. Petraeus doesn't have American political sense. You know, that I'm true, you know, Congress and in the sense of Washington, he probably is, you know, insecure himself about running for president. What does he know about that? With or without Fox. You know, he probably looked at it, this is sheer speculation, it's 2016, and spent 3 or 4 years at the CIA. This guy gets out. I got a shot then. He needed a civilian job to really begin to understand Washington. Now, what I heard, and I keep on hearing this repeatedly, and this is sheer, not sheer speculation, but informed speculation, that Petraeus, look, I what I can tell you is the FBI does not go after a CIA director for adultery or strange IP addresses or we're having an affair with an author, especially an officer, a reserve officer in the American military. They just don't care. You can barely get them. They're so busy to follow up terrorist leads. So they wouldn't go after this. So I take that fact and the fact that I've heard over and over again that it was people at the CIA were aware of this affair. They didn't like Petraeus. He brought this military mentality. He was arrogant. You know, he would order pineapple, on his trips, 2 pounds of it, cord not sliced, extra tomatoes for his runs, water bottles. And not only that, he was, I've heard from CIA people that he was messing with the finished product, National Intelligence Estimate. He considered himself a bit of a wordsmith. He liked to change things. He liked to, I presume redo assessments on Afghanistan. And so the FBI and senior CIA officers got together. You know, how they actually did it, I don't know.
But it was an inside job.
And, of course, the White House knew about this from the beginning.
But in short, it was an inside job that they decided to get rid of this guy from within.
This wasn't White House dirty work. This is just CIA. CIA people do tend to reject outsiders who cause waves. I've seen it over and over. They did it with John Deutsch, a CIA director under Bill Clinton. He'd take his computer home. Same thing happened. They sort of destroyed his reputation because he was arrogant.
Well, you've left us with quite a lot to think about here, Robert Baird. I thank you very, very much for joining us here today.
I left you a lot of speculation. But anyhow, there you go.
Informed speculation. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon and Syria. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further about the Syrian tragedy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Glass, who was ABC News' chief Middle East correspondent from 1983 to 1993. He's the author of Tribes with Flags, Adventure and Kidnap in Greater Syria, and has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Aleppo, How Syria is Being Destroyed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Glass.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we started out earlier with former CIA officer Robert Baer, who was the character that was portrayed in the movie Syriana. He served in Lebanon largely and in Syria and is in touch with the Alawites and believes that although the Russians have now, Deputy Foreign Minister has said that maybe the rebels are going to win, and I think they're starting to think about evacuating Russians from Syria. Robert Baer suggested that this is not really the end yet; that there's a lot more agony to come. What's your sense of how much more bloodletting will go on?
Bob Baer's assessment sounds right to me. The regime is not about to collapse by any means, and all the reports I've read out of Damascus in the last few days indicate that it's holding tough in the city and giving up ground in the countryside. But remember that the cities have the bulk of the population, so effectively they are in control of most of the people of the country. while the rebels were in control of certain villages and country areas, some of the roads leading to between the cities.
Well, you, in your article in the New York Review of Books, Charles Glass, Aleppo, How Syria is Being Destroyed, you make the case that, in effect, that this is a civil war or a war, but there are three wars within this war. It's a class war of the suburban proletariat against a state army financed by the bourgeoisie. It's a sectarian war in which the Sunni Arab majority is fighting to displace the Alawi ruling class. And it's a holy war of Sunni Muslims against all manifestations of Shiism, especially the Alawite variety. So is this, of all of that, in this sort of toxic stew, what do you expect to come out in, if indeed the Free Syrian Army is going to be victorious?
Well, the thing is that the three you mentioned, the three wars, those internal wars, to those you must add the external wars that are going on. The U.S. is competing with Russia there. Saudi Arabia is competing with Iran there. Israel is competing on... There are voices in Israel on both sides of the situation. Some Israelis saying it's better to keep the Alawite regime in place rather than have Sunni Muslim fundamentalists come in who could rock the boat and disrupt the status quo on the Golan Heights. So there are many local and international battles all being fought on Syrian soil. The long term seems to be, because both sides are strong, neither can defeat the other, that the war will simply go on, and in the midst of that war being prolonged, the country is being destroyed, and more people are being made homeless, more and more people are fleeing the country, and more people are being killed.
Well, that's what's so heartbreaking about your article in the New York Review of Books, Charles Glass, Aleppo, How Syria is Being Destroyed, is that you have witnessed and documented the destruction. And my understanding is that the ancient souk in Aleppo, wasn't that a World Heritage Site? I mean, that goes back to what?
Most of Aleppo is the UNESCO World Heritage Site. Aleppo, according to the UN, is one of those rare places where almost 80% of its medieval architecture is still intact. And these are buildings, souks, the citadel, churches, mosques, and synagogues. These things are now being destroyed in the war between two sides, the regime and the rebels. Neither really cares about the city itself.
Well, my understanding is that when the rebels take over an area, that the government, in effect, decides to do collective punishment by destroying the area.
They're trying to destroy the rebels, so the rebels go into a neighborhood, declare it a liberated zone, and the government goes in to get them out. And so the civilians have to flee because they're going to get killed in the middle.
So do you think that you've suggested, as Bob Baer has, that the agony will go on for some time? What's going to be left of Syria? I mean, it's
as long as the Russians and the Iranians go on arming the regime and encouraging the regime to fight, and as long as the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, France, and Britain go on arming the opposition and encouraging the opposition to be intransigent, then the fighting will go on, the country will be destroyed. But if those outside powers were to come together and force the two sides to negotiate a reasonable period of transition leading to free elections where the Syrian people will choose the leaders they want and the form of government they want, then that would be the way out.
Well, Hezbollah has come out today, Sheikh Nasrallah, saying that there's no way that the Free Syrian Army is going to win. The Iranians seem to be pouring in arms on a regular basis. The U.S. has always expressed confidence that Assad would go, and now the Russians are suggesting that maybe the rebels are going to win. So who is...
The Mikhail Bogdanov has actually been contradicted by other Russian foreign ministry officials. I don't think that's a general Kremlin view. That seems to have been his view. It was his view last August as well, and the regime didn't fall then. There seems to be a lot of predictions by people outside who have not set foot in Syria that the regime is so weak it's going to collapse any minute. Well, it has not collapsed. It didn't collapse a year ago when Hillary Clinton said it would, and it's probably not going to collapse in the next few months.
So we can't, these people are not speaking out of any knowledge. They're just speaking out of their own particular investments and political biases.
Yes, it's best to be there and to speak to people who are living there and understand what they're going through to be able to appreciate the situation in the country.
Right. Well, that's what you've done in your article, Aleppo House Syria's Being Destroyed, and we're very grateful to you, Charles Glass, for joining us and being able to share this article with us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Glass, who is ABC News's chief Middle East correspondent from 1983 to 1993. He's the author of Tribes with Flags, Adventure and Kidnapping in Greater Syria, and he has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Aleppo, How Syria is Being Destroyed. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre.
Against humanity, while each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Oh, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre in April of 2007, the worst shooting in American history. He, while enrolled as a fourth-year student at Virginia Tech pursuing an international studies degree, Colin Goddard was shot four times and was one out of seven of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. He has three of the four bullets still in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. An accidental crusader against gun violence, his story is documented in the film Living for 32, and as the Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C., Colin Goddard is currently traveling around the country with the film and sharing his story in an effort to educate, advocate, and mobilize Americans to get involved in preventing gun violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Goddard.
Thanks for having me.
And Colin, of course, as it happens, we talk tragically too often, and because every time I talk to you, it's usually after the last one was the Aurora shooting in Colorado, then just more recently there was a shooting in a shopping mall in Oregon, and now, of course, this appalling tragedy in Connecticut, which is the second worst shooting since the Virginia Tech massacre that you were a victim of. But I think in terms of moral outrage, and I think the extent to which we have to look at ourselves as a country and as a people and take responsibility and own what just happened, the hideous nature of what just happened is so appalling that I had to turn off the media. I mean, I feel sorry for you, Colin, that you've got a job to do, right?
Right. I mean, I was trying to wrap my head around what happened in Oregon last week, and then, you know, when I got to the office on Friday morning and turned on my Twitter feed, and I saw it come over my Twitter feed, I was deflated in my chair. I couldn't believe it. And when I heard it was at an elementary school, you know, I knew this was going to be bad. And, it's been a tough 24 hours, 48 hours for me, but I mean, the folks in Connecticut are in a much worse spot. I mean, I know what they're going through now. I know what it's like, to get that phone call and have to make that phone call to a loved one, telling them that you're in the hospital or they got to go to a hospital for somebody that they care about, and not knowing how they are. Hospitals don't really tell you over the phone the condition of your loved one until you get there. But, it's been incredible what I have seen, the out the outpouring of support and the outrage on this issue, particularly since Friday, than I've ever been before. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like this. And I think just the, you know, just the fact that this was little kids, man, I mean, is just making people understand that there really is something that needs to change. And I think people are understanding that if they just send their sympathies and condolences and get light candles, that's not going to stop this next thing from happening again to somebody else. And they're realizing that it's their involvement, it's their outrage and activity that's going to change things. It's really going to be all of us coming together to demand that we have a safer country for all of us. And I believe it's a matter of when, not if.
So, Colin, what this latest massacre at the school in Connecticut seems to have in common with the Virginia Tech shooting, of which you were a victim, and you still carry three of the four bullets in you, and you were shot four times, and you one out of seven of the class of 17 to survive the shooting. It looks as though the perpetrator of this latest outrage had mental illness. And there's no question that the perpetrator of the Virginia Tech shooting also had mental illness. And it turns out that the state judge had deemed him mentally ill, but that information was not in the FBI's database. So it's extraordinary for all of the platitudes we hear about, you know, we'll get through this, we'll get through it, and we'll come out stronger at the other end and all that nonsense that goes on in the media when these things happen. Nobody wants to actually talk about why they keep happening. And to my mind, the real issue to focus on here is that there is no correlation for law enforcement between those who are mentally ill and those who are able to buy firearms.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that talking about gun policy and mental health policies has been taboo in this country for some time, but I think it's really incidences like these that bring these issues back to light, and I think we're understanding that these keep coming up. We have to really address this, and I'm absolutely right. Shootings like Virginia Tech and this one in Connecticut kind of highlight the intersect between our gun policy and our mental health policy. You know, I mean, it's fundamentally that the people, happy people, don't do things like this, you know. And it's a subject area that, you know, is now being talked about, which is long overdue in my opinion. You know, we really have to understand that, you know, we've already failed these kids in Connecticut. I mean, we shouldn't be totally setting our policies based on the most recent shooting that just occurred. You know, we should be thinking about the next group of children who we can save, who we could prevent having to go through something like that. You know, that's when you should step back and you look at, well, what really makes sense? You know, what, should we do something about the 40% of gun sales that occur in this country that go unchecked in every year? I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. There is not just one single policy, you know, with guns or mental health that's gonna you know, save everybody. But it's really a strong framework of it all working together and communicating together that's going to make things improve for all of us, you know. I learned that the guy in Connecticut tried to buy a gun at a store, but because of Connecticut's law that requires a waiting period, he left and didn't go that route. Instead, he went to his mother, who apparently did not have the guns locked and stored safely, and also he's not required to report any stolen guns. So, you know, you really need a strong framework of these policies to help identify people who could be dangerous to themselves or others, get them the help that they need, but also limit their easy availability that they have to dangerous, lethal firepower.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre of 2007, the worst shooting in American history, while enrolled as a fourth-year student of Virginia Tech, pursuing an international studies degree. Colin Goddard was shot four times and was one out of seven of the class of 17 to survive the shooting. He still has three of the four bullets in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. One of the things that I find extraordinary about this repeated atrocities is that when A crazy guy tried to ignite a shoe aboard an airplane, the so-called shoe bomber. What that resulted in was a national regime where we all have to take our shoes off at airports. So there's the cause and effect is massive. The whole government jumped into gear and came up with this regime as a result of one person's actions. Yet time and time again, these people shoot any number of innocent victims and just massacre them in the way that happened to you at Virginia Tech and just happened in Connecticut, and nothing happens. Now, there's an article in Sunday's New York Times, the Justice Department shelved ideas to improve gun background checks, apparently after the shooting of the congresswoman in Arizona, Gabby Giffords. The Justice Department looked into improving laws to prevent future massacres. And they apparently got completely sidetracked by this bogus, ginned-up, pseudo-controversy that Daryl Issa and the Republicans came up with over the so-called Operation Fast and Furious. So give us a sense, since you work for the Brady campaign in Washington trying to bring about sensible gun laws, give us a sense of what you're up against, because clearly nobody in this country seems to be able to get a handle on why it is that nothing can be done. And we all know that at the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with the NRA, the National Rifle Association.
Right, but I mean, I really don't know why the NRA is involved in this discussion. I mean, you know, what happened at that school in Connecticut was not somebody exercising their Second Amendment rights, so this really shouldn't be part of the discussion. You know, unfortunately, I think the first part of the lack of action comes from the fact that most Americans assume that we already have these laws in place that keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people to begin with. I mean, that's what I thought before I got shot and was blown away when I learned that we actually don't even do background checks on everybody, you know, let alone have systems of licensing and registration that I thought were in place. So once people realize that, you know, there are steps that we can take that we just, our decision makers just have chosen not to yet, then they realize, wow, you know, this is something that needs to be done. And I think that's the disconnect. You know, we also have to, you know, make it so that our elected officials understand that there is a large number of their constituents who want to see something done. And the more people voice that directly to those who represent them, it creates a space for these people to not worry so much about what money could be thrown at them from the gun manufacturers and their lobbying arm in the NRA, and do what's right for the public safety of all of us. You know, I mean, nobody wants to see what happened in Connecticut happen again, you know? And it really means that the missing piece has been the outrage. You know, many, many fundamental changes and problems in our country have resulted from public outrage, sustained outrage, and sustained involvement in the civic process until something is done. You know, this is on every level, from local government all the way to our president. And speaking to our president, I mean, his remarks that he gave on Friday, you know, that we have to take meaningful action despite the politics, I think, you know, he's getting at what we're getting at here. I mean, the man is from Chicago. I think he understands gun violence in a very fundamental way. But the politics for him have left him to think previously that he couldn't do anything. So now we need to show him that, yes, he can do something about this. And so that's why we created wearebetterthanthis.org for people who believe that we are better than this, that we deserve a nation that's safer than this, to go and voice their concerns with us, to engage with us, and we can all then direct ourselves towards, you know, the correct elected official at the correct time to make sure this, you know, something actually gets done, so that what happened in Newtown, Connecticut becomes less likely to happen to another American city.
Well, Colin Gunnard, we did do something about it. We did have an assault weapons ban, and then it was allowed to expire in 2004. And the champion of that assault weapons ban was Senator Dianne Feinstein, who rose to prominence here in the state of California because her colleague was shot in San Francisco. And it was depicted in a movie about Harvey Milk, who was also one of the, but Mayor Moscone was her boss at the time. And she is now reintroducing the same legislation, the assault weapons ban. What's your sense of her chances? I think it's probably going to happen on Monday.
Well, I've had heard that as well, and I do believe that it's actually not the, it's not the same bill that she had introduced before. It's updated. It's been improved. I mean, she understood that, you know, the problems and the flaws in the original bill, and, you know, to the extent that firearm manufacturers were able to change a few cosmetic features on their guns and then rename them and basically put the same kind of firepower weapon back out there on the market. So, you know, she's understood that. I hope she's addressed that in this new language. I mean, we've had an inundation of phone calls from people here in D.C. and folks from state legislatures across the country looking to see how, you know, what can we do? What can we do to make some progress to move forward? You know, like I said, this is the time for all of us to let our elected officials know that this is something we want them to do, that we have their back. If they take up, you know, if they go out and stand up on this issue, they don't have to worry about the gun lobby. They should be more concerned about each one of us and our safety. And we have to prove that to them now. And if we do, I mean, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that they would make the right decision. You know, so for, you know, to the extent that all of us can engage on this issue at this time when it is most critical, I implore everyone listening to please do so.
Well, Colin Gunnard, the president will be speaking later today in Newtown, Connecticut. And, I don't know what he's going to say. A lot of people are hoping he'll say something meaningful. He did indicate that he might. His press secretary made a ridiculous statement. But we'll see. What are you expecting to say? Or I guess also, what do you hope he says?
I mean, he's said previously very specific things on our background check system that allows people, you know, to be denied from one gun seller and turn around and buy a gun from somebody else without a check. You know, he understands the reality of that situation. He understands, you know, that military weapons are being shown up on our streets from, you know, inner city Chicago to our schools in Connecticut, you know. I mean, he understands, you know, the specific policy initiatives that could help save lives. You know, we have to take this, and actually I've seen this, which is heartening, is to see the media no longer speaking in the sense of, oh, well, should everybody have a gun or should we get rid of all guns? I mean, neither of those two options is a reality in this country. So we should look at what is, which is the reasonable middle ground, which is legitimate background checks on every single gun sale, which is limiting the types of military firepower that we sell to the general public. You know, the president has spoken to those two points exactly, and I think that's where a lot of us have consensus. Even the times that we've polled NRA members and gun owners, those are two issues where we find a broad level of support. You know, it's really what we hear about in the NRA is just their leadership, is their big bosses and CEOs and fundraisers here in D.C. But the average American, the average decent human being understands that background checks on all gun sales and limiting the types of military weapons is something that we all need to get done.
But Colin Gunnard, it seems to require more in a sense that if we drive a vehicle, which could be a lethal weapon because we have a lot of people killed in car accidents, presumably that is why you go through a fairly rigorous process to get a driver's license, and you have to be tested by the state, and allowed as a license to drive a car. It's the same thing with flying an aeroplane. You have to have a certain amount of skill because, there are lives at stake. Well, there are lives at stake with guns. And here you have a situation that just happened where this mother, who was the first victim of this latest massacre, had this gun collection, and she had a mentally disturbed son, and he apparently was able to get to her guns. And you mentioned, I didn't really know this, but he apparently had previously tried to buy a gun in Connecticut. So I don't understand why it is that she could have an arsenal at home and not be required to secure it and be more socially responsible. I mean, I just don't understand why it is that we have to have licenses for other things that could cause death, but not, or the abuse of which could cause death, and not for guns, which the specific purpose of guns is to cause death.
Ian, I think a lot of that makes sense, you know. But unfortunately, you know, this issue as it's been, stagnant for so long, you know, we're trying to get on base here. You know, we're not swinging for the home run. You know, we're trying to get on base. We're trying to put points on the board. This is you know, these two issues are the particular two where there is so much common ground, you know, and we're going with that. You know, and this is why I joined this fight. This is why I joined this cause. This is why I work for the Brady campaign. I mean, I'm not in this for a career, for a lifelong working on gun policy. I'm in this to move, to do my part, to move the ball forward, and to legitimize a market that is currently not legitimate and allows dangerous people, people with records, to easily get their hands on a gun. You know, that's going to be some low-hanging fruit that we can fix. And we can, and the result will, it will become a safer place for all of us, not just at our schools or at our daycare centers or at our churches or at our malls or movie theaters. That's safer for everyone. And I think that's the first step that we can all take together.
Well, Colin Goddard, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre of April 2007, the worst shooting in American history. Now, of course, the second worst has just occurred in Newtown, Connecticut, involving 26 and 7-year-old schoolchildren, along with five female teachers and the mother of the disturbed young man who conducted this massacre, and of course he killed himself. While enrolled as a fourth-year student at Virginia Tech, pursuing an international studies degree, Colin Goddard was shot four times and was one out of seven of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. He has three of the four bullets still in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. He's an accidental crusader against gun violence, and his story is documented in the film Living for 32. And as the Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C., Colin Goddard currently travels across the country with the film and shares his story in an effort to educate, advocate, and mobilize Americans to get involved in preventing gun violence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll answer your questions as best I can. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time for